Welcome to Wordland. I'm your host, David Oates. This week we have Cajun storyteller J.J. Renaud and WUGA's own Robin Whetstone. I first heard this story of falling into a coup in process at a storytelling meet in town.
My name is Robin Whetstone, and this is Red Ticket. A story of what happened after the collapse of the Soviet Union. It's a story about what happens when the institutions, infrastructure, and ethos we've come to rely on fail. It's a story about societal and personal collapse. This is Chapter 1. It's called The Coup. When I was 20 years old, back in 1991, I was studying Russian at the University of Florida, and I had the opportunity to go with some of my classmates to Moscow for the summer and study for 6 weeks. And my classmates flew over there as a group together, but I was very fortunate to have spent a little bit of time in Europe before going to Moscow. So when it came time to go for my study period, I took a 3-day train trip from London to Moscow. And that meant that at the end of the 6 weeks, I had to take a 3-day train ride from Moscow back to London in order to catch my plane back to Florida. At the end of the study period, my classmates all got on a bus together to go to the airport, but I needed to get to the train station. And I was anxious about the trip because it had been such an arduous journey on the way out to Moscow. And so I decided to treat myself. Instead of going to the metro, I decided to stick my arm out and try to hail a car that would drive me to the train station. And I always wonder, given what happened next, what would have happened if I had decided to take the metro? But I didn't. I stuck my arm out and immediately a guy in a cream-colored Lada pulled over. Now, he wasn't a taxi driver. He was a regular old Muscovite who was trying to make a few extra rubles by giving a stranger a ride. And this happened all the time in Russia and still does, as far as I know. So we agreed on a 5-ruble price. I threw my backpack in the car, and he drove me to one of the biggest train stations in Moscow because this was an international train station. And when we got there, he surprised me by offering to go in with me and get my ticket sorted out. And I was very surprised by this. I knew that this was above and beyond the 5-ruble service. But I was so glad when we walked into the lobby of this train station that I had taken him up on his offer. And again, this is another moment where I wonder, what would have happened if I had said no to his offer? But I didn't. I said yes. And when we got in there, it was just mass chaos. It was impossible for me as a foreigner to understand what was going on. There were hundreds of people in this lobby all milling around, some of them with duffel bags full of live chickens. And in front of each kassa or ticket window, there were 50 or 100 Russians just in a disorderly mob in front of all these windows. I would have had no idea what to do. But he grabbed me by the wrist and he pulled me up to the front of one of these lines. And he and the ticket taker immediately started yelling at each other like they had been interrupted in a fight that they had been having and were now resuming it. They're just screaming at each other. And I can't figure out what's going on. I'm just standing there looking around. I'm kind of stunned. And after a little while, he turns to me and he looks very cheerful and he says, there is small problem with ticket. Your train, it will be a little bit late. Oh, I think. Well, that's too bad. But, you know, this is an interesting setting here. I can stand to stay here and watch people for 3 hours or, you know, maybe even 6 hours. That's not the end of the world. You expect those kind of things when you're traveling. So I said, oh, well, how late? And he says, September 25th. What? I said. Now, I'm no good at math, but I know this is August 16th. And September 25th is over a month away. What am I supposed to do for more than a month by myself in Moscow. I realized that I don't know anybody in this entire country now that my school group has left. I have no money except for a couple of traveler's checks, which are useless because in communist Russia, traveler's checks aren't really a thing. And I have no place to stay. I mean, maybe in America, I could lurk around in all-night cafes or movie theaters or libraries or something. But this is Soviet Russia. And loitering, hanging around with no place to go, will get you sent straight to Gulag. So I'm thinking all of this, and he has handed me my bag, and he's walking away. And so I just yell, kind of without thinking. I yell, "Hey, wait." And he turns around. "Yes," he says. And I tell him what's going on. And he has this very classic, broad Slavic face, like real Russian. And he gets this very sly look on his face. And he says, "Oh, well, then you must come home with me." And I realize he's right. I must come home with him. So we walk out back to the car, and I throw my backpack in the back seat and get in the front seat. And we're driving down the road, and he is looking very cheerful. And he says, "You are 20, you say? That is well. I am 21. My name is Dmitry Orlov, and I am famous actor." Right, I think to myself. You, Dmitry Orlov, with your cruddy Lada, and your dorky acid-washed jeans and your scruffy face, I am sure you are a famous actor, but, you know, I'm from America, and everybody knows that Americans love movies because Hollywood is in America after all, right? So, yes, I am just so sure you're a famous actor, but you're also the only thing standing between me and the gulag. So, okay, great, a famous actor. Wow, that's neat. We're driving down the road and we're going through the city, and then he turns off onto a slightly smaller street, and then he turns off onto an even smaller street. It's a residential area. Maybe he lives here. But then he turns off onto something that isn't even really a street. It's just a path through this enormous field of dry grass. And it's like the kind of path that my grandfather used to walk cows down in North Florida. It's got two rutted tracks where the tires go and then grass in the middle. And there are no buildings. There's no one else around. And I think to myself, here we go. Already. And I'm clenching my fists. I'm ready to spring on this guy. When we pull up behind this blue Olga, and Dmitry cuts the engine. And I look at him and I say, "Dmitry, what are we doing here?" And he says, "This is line for gas. I am sorry it is so long." "Wow," I say, and I get out of the car and climb up onto the hood. And way off in the distance, I can see some sort of edifice that looks kind of like a toll booth with people milling around it and cars parked underneath it. So I get back in the car and I'm thinking, you know, maybe this guy isn't an actor, but maybe he's not a homicidal rapist either. Maybe he's just a nice guy who is trying to help and who needs gas. We sat in this line for 3 hours waiting for gas. And eventually, after a long time, I had finally exhausted all of the questions that I had about this gas station. Like, why is this gas station line so long? Is this the only place in the entire country to get gas? How did you know it was here? There are no signs. Is gas rationed? Is this the only day that you can get gas? Why are there so many people here? What if you had something that you were supposed to do? Are you just supposed to sit here all day and wait for gas? Look, this line is really long. There are 5 bays up there to pull the cars into. Why don't they make 5 short lines instead of 1 really long line? It would take so much less time and be so much more efficient. Dmitry, this is a really bad system. Finally, I was out of questions, and I just sat there in grumpy silence while Dmitry, sanguine in the driver's seat, beat out a Queen song on the steering wheel and hummed along. He seemed like he was used to this. At one point, I reached into my pocket and pulled out a pack of cigarettes. "Can I smoke?" I said. "Niet," said Dimitri, who looked terrified. "Smoking is impossible. We will explode." I started laughing. "Dimitri, did you know that in America we make a distinction between not allowed and not possible? But here you don't. Here, if something is not allowed, it's also physically not possible. Isn't that interesting?" Dimitri looked like he was sorry he had picked me up. "Do you understand what I'm saying?" I asked him, leaning forward and raising my voice just a little. "Da, da, понятно. My English is very good because I have been in many films." Finally, after 3 hours, we pulled up in front of Dimitri's apartment on Moscow's Ring Road. The whole day had been wasted, fighting with the ticket taker at the train station and waiting for gas. I was exhausted and starving. I didn't much care what waited for me at Dimitri's apartment. As long as I did not have to wait in a line, I would be fine. We climb up the stairs and go in the door, the front door of his apartment. And we're in this brightly lit foyer that has a hallway running off to the right and off to the left. And directly in front of us is this living room that is behind a pair of French doors. And this living room is stuffed full of antiques. And as we come in, two of these antiques, a man and a woman of about 70 years old, look up at us expectantly. And Dimitri says to them, "This is Robin. She is an American girl, and she is going to be staying with us for a few days." And the two people nod, and Dimitri shepherds me off to the right to his room. We get in his room, and we sit down together on his bed. And I say to Dimitri, "Dimitri, your roommates are certainly old. Where did you find them?" "They are my parents," he says. And then he grabs me in a tight embrace and gives me a big sloppy kiss on the mouth. "Mmm," he says. I pulled away and tried to look chaste. I said the one thing I could think of that would help him understand that this is not where we were going with this. "Oh, Dimitri," I said, "as much as I would love to kiss you, I cannot. I have a boyfriend back home." "Eh, it's okay," says Dimitri. We sit there in awkward silence for a couple of minutes, and I'm looking around the room, which looks like the room of any 21-year-old boy anywhere. There are tennis shoes and piles of clothes, books and record albums scattered all over the place. There are celebrity snapshots taped up on the wall, Paula Abdul and Arnold Schwarzenegger. But wait a minute, I notice. These things that are pinned to the wall, they're actually photographs taken from an actual camera. They're not cut out of a magazine. And who is this person in these pictures giving Arnold Schwarzenegger a manly hug and Paula Abdul a big drooly kiss? It's none other than Dimitri, my Russian rescuer. "Dimitri," I say, tapping him on the shoulder, "what are you doing in these pictures with Paula Abdul and Arnold Schwarzenegger?" "Ech, I told you," he says, "I am famous actor. I come from family of famous actors, is what we do. Maybe you have seen this film, Terminator 2. I was second man who gets blown up in opening sequence." "Wow," I said, "the second man who gets blown up." I had indeed seen Terminator 2, but I did not remember this scene. "Dimitri," I said, "that's really cool."
"Yes," said Dimitri, "it's cool."
I spent that night, which was Friday, as well as Saturday and Sunday night, with Dimitri and his family. I slept in the living room on the sofa with Nick, the family's much-loved collie. In the mornings, I would get up and go into the kitchen and sit with Dimitri's mother as she made me blini, or Russian pancakes. During the day, Dimitri would take me to his cousin's dacha, where he lent me his prized possession, a denim jacket with an Elvis Presley pin on it. He took me to an Armenian pizza place, where we had pizza with potatoes and mayonnaise on it. I met all of his friends. I went to all of the major Russian cultural sites.
Basically, he was touring me all around the country. He was a great host. But I was really nervous. Dimitri, I kept saying to him, please, you have got to take me to some airline offices so I can see about getting a ticket out of here. I have got to be in London by Tuesday because my plane is taking off on Tuesday. We will go after we visit the Novodevichy Monastery, he would say. Turgenev is buried there. On Sunday morning, I got up and went into the kitchen for my morning cup of tea and blini, and his mother came and sat down next to me with a serious look on her face. Robin, she said, will your family be coming over? For what? I said. For the wedding, she said. Oh, no. I didn't know what Dimitri had been telling his family to make my presence in their house acceptable, but clearly it was time to have a serious talk with him. Sunday night, I sat him down on the couch. Dimitri, I have got to go home. I have got to catch a plane on Tuesday from London. This is Sunday night. Tomorrow is my last chance. If you won't take me to some airline offices, I am going to have to go by myself. Please, Dimitri. I have a family at home and a boyfriend. They're going to be worried about me if I'm not on that plane. I miss my family. I realized that this was true and started to cry. Dimitri agreed that tomorrow morning he would take me to the Aeroflot offices, and I went to sleep on the couch that night, feeling anxious, but a little relieved. The next morning, I woke up at 6:58, according to the clock on the side table. I lay under the warm duvet and tried not to think about what was before me that day. I tried to concentrate on the patterns that the light made on the walls, but slowly the tension began to creep in. This was my last chance. If I didn't find a way to get out of this country, I was going to miss my plane, and then how would I get home? You are stranded in Moscow, about to be married off to the stranger whose couch you're sleeping on, I thought. Things really cannot get any worse. Literally 5 seconds after I formed this thought, the French doors to the living room flew open and Dimitri burst in. He was running around in circles and pulling at his frizzy blonde hair, and he seemed to be near tears. Get up! Get up! He screamed at me. Put on your pants! We have got to get out of here now! Get up! This was so out of character for Dimitri that I almost laughed. I pulled the covers up to my nose and watched him run around the room some more. In his distress, Dimitri had apparently completely forgotten how to speak English. Gorbachev kaput! He screamed. Vojna na ulitsya! Vojna na ulitsya! I got out of bed and went over to the window, which looked down on Moscow's Ring Road, which is a main thoroughfare in Moscow. There was a woman in a black coat walking her terrier down the sidewalk, and the morning was still and quiet. Dimitri, I said, turning to him, there is no war in the streets. What are you talking about? What is going on? Perevarot! Yelled Dimitri, resuming his running in circles. Perevarot! Then he burst into tears and ran out of the room, leaving me alone with the quiet morning. Perevarot was a word I had never heard before. I knew that the prefix pere meant around, but I had no idea how to puzzle out the meaning of the rest of the word. I reached for my red Katzner's dictionary that I carried with me everywhere and sat there, flipping through it until I found the word. Now I know that this word, along with every other word in the dictionary, had to have a bunch of information with it, like an N for noun or different meanings, or maybe a sentence showing how it's used. But I swear, when I looked at this word, the meaning of that word was there all by itself, in all caps, in a font that was several sizes bigger than the other words around it. When I looked at that word and the meaning clicked into focus, it made a noise that other people could hear. Perevarot, it said. Revolution. Oh, I said, closing my dictionary. Suddenly, things had gotten a whole lot worse. I ran from the room and turned right into the hallway, headed toward the kitchen. When I got to Dimitri's parents' room, I skidded to a stop. His father was sitting on the edge of the bed, still in his nightclothes. He had a radio cradled in his lap, from which came the bombastic pronouncements of an angry-sounding man. I stood there and watched, saying nothing, as tears fell from this man's face onto the radio. It didn't seem right to say anything. I didn't want him to know that I had seen him. So I continued running toward the kitchen. Surely I would go in there and I would see Dimitri's mother and we would have a cup of tea and we would sit and talk in the sunny kitchen about the plans for the day or the upcoming wedding. When I got to the kitchen, Dimitri's mother was standing frozen in front of a sizzling pan of blinis, the spatula out in front of her, and she was listening to the same man on a radio on the sideboard. I spun around and ran back toward Dimitri's room. I was scared, but what I really was confused. I needed some information about what was going on. Who were these people who had made my Russian family cry? What do you mean, Voina no ulitsia? What is this revolution? Dimitri was sitting on the couch in the living room watching television. I sat down next to him. On the screen, 6 or 8 men sat at a curved desk in front of a gray background. All of them looked tired. Several of them looked scared. The man in the middle, who was clearly in charge, was reading from a set of prepared notes. I couldn't understand what he was saying, but it was clear from his tone that the jig was up. He was chastising us for our stupid mistakes. No more, he was saying. Dimitri, I whined, shaking his shoulder. What is going on? He is saying, is over, said Dimitri. He is saying, communism is coming back and things are going back to the way they were. Dimitri, I said, jumping up and frantically throwing things in my backpack, you have got to take me to the U.S. Embassy. Do you understand? You've got to take me to the embassy. Yes, okay, said Dimitri, standing up and numbly walking out of the room. I stood with Dimitri and his parents in the foyer as we put on our outside shoes. As he handed Dimitri the keys to the car, his father said, get her out of here. And I couldn't tell if he meant it for my benefit because he was worried for me and he wanted me to get home, or if he was saying it because he was worried for them, because suddenly an American houseguest was no longer a novelty, but a liability, and maybe even a deadly one. I felt like a grenade with the pin pulled as his parents hugged me gingerly. We went downstairs to Dimitri's car and got in. We drove a ways down the road and pulled up in front of the U.S. Embassy. I showed my passport to the guard at the gate and went into the lobby. There was a man of about my age standing behind the counter. Can I help you? He said. I sure hope so, I said. Listen, you must know what's going on outside, and I'm not here to ask you for help or for money or anything like that. I just need some advice. I told him the particulars of my story, and when I was done, I said, what would you do if you were me? He kind of snorted, and then, I am not making this up, he said, dude, you're fucked. I was astounded, but in too much of a hurry for his reply to really register. So I said, can I use your phone? Do you have $4? He said. I turned on my heel and ran out of the embassy. That avenue for help had been cut off. I had to figure out what else to do. I got back in the car. Where to now? Said Dimitri. Dimitri, take me to British Airways, please. I have no idea why I said this. I didn't even know if there was a British Airways office in Russia, but I figured my own country had turned its back on me, and the safest place to ride out what was apparently a coup would be with the British. So Dimitri starts driving further down the ring road. We go about a quarter of a mile before we have to stop because these blue barricades were up in the middle of the road blocking things off. I was in a big hurry. This was Monday. I had about 24 hours to make it out of Moscow to London. But still, I got out of the car with Dimitri. A short ways away, we could see a big, pristine white building that was set in a big plaza. Dimitri, what is this building? I said. It is Russian White House, he said to me, where President lives. We walked across the plaza toward the building. It was early in the morning, maybe 9 o'clock, and there were only about 50 people there. As the day wore on, the crowd would swell into the hundreds of thousands, but at this point, it was still small. There were a couple of bored-looking policemen standing on the plaza smoking cigarettes, and three or four cameramen running around taking shots of the small crowd and of the big white building. I watched the cameramen filming, and suddenly I had an idea. If I had been at home watching this unfold on CNN with my family, I would have had much more information about what was going on. I would have heard a story that went something like, "This morning, communist hardliners placed Gorbachev under house arrest and have barricaded themselves in the White House. They assert that the reforms of perestroika have gone too far, too fast, and are trying to overthrow Gorbachev so that communism can return." Today, when I tell this story, people say, "Oh, how wonderful that you got to witness this historic event." But back then, for me, and for the 50 or so people who were standing there watching this unfold, we had no idea what was happening. We only knew that it was bad. But these cameramen, I thought, if they're here filming, they must have some idea of what they're filming, some kind of context to put it in. So I ran across the Ring Road to the main plaza of the White House, and I accosted each one of them, one after the other. And all of them desperately tried to get away from me as I blocked their view of history in the making. They tried to duck and parry and avoid me, but none of them were successful. I grabbed all of them by the shoulders and yelled, "What is going on? Do you know? Do you know?" into their surprised faces. And as I was doing this, it occurred to me that I was yelling my question not at the cameraman, but I was looking straight into the lens of the camera. And I remembered thinking about the absurdity of this as I was doing it and how audiences in Toulouse or Seoul or Hamburg would be shocked when the face of a hysterical American suddenly burst into their broadcast. None of the cameramen could tell me anything. None of them spoke English. "No, no, nein, nein," they all screamed, desperately trying to get away from me. "Hey," I thought pathetically, "I bet I'm on TV somewhere right now." Then a much darker thought occurred to me. What if CNN is here right now? I looked around nervously, and they film me, and my mother, who I was absolutely sure would be watching, sees me. I'm not even supposed to be in Moscow right now, and definitely not at a coup. If my mother sees me on TV, I am going to catch it when I get home. I turned and ran back across the Ring Road to the Riverfront Plaza in front of the White House and tried to blend in with the crowd, which had swelled to several hundred people by now. I stood at the very front of this crowd with Dmitry and watched as a group of Russians carrying a tricolored banner climbed the stairs of the White House and started chanting something. "Dmitry," I said, "what is that they're holding? What are they saying?" "That is Russian flag," said Dmitry. "They are saying, 'We will sooner die than give up our country.'" The question of whether or not they'd have to hung there between us. "Dmitry," I said for the thousandth time that morning, "what is happening?" This time Dmitry seemed to know. He spread his arms out wide. "You are witnessing the death of my country," he said. And then he started to cry. After a while, the Russians holding the flag left, and a man dressed as a priest climbed up the steps of the White House and began addressing the crowd. "Dmitry," I said, "who is that guy dressed like a priest?" "He is priest," said Dmitry. The crowd got bigger and bigger, and it was angry. Several thousand people were pressing at my back, and people in the back of the crowd were shouting angry things that I could not understand. A very old woman materialized next to me, and she seemed particularly angry. Every couple of minutes, she would look at me and make an emphatic pronouncement with which I would just as emphatically agree. I was afraid of the crowd, afraid of what it would do. But I couldn't leave. There was no question. I had to see what would happen. What happened was this. After about an hour of standing there, an enormous wail went up from the crowd. We looked to the right And coming toward us on the ring road, which was directly in front of me, were 24 Army tanks. I counted them. 24 tanks is a lot of tanks, especially when they are driving right up to where you are standing. The crowd surged backward as the tanks pulled up on the ring road right in front of us, separating our riverfront plaza from the plaza that led up to the White House. When they had distributed themselves along the ring road in between the crowd and the White House, they turned off their engines. Their guns were pointed at us, and it was clear that they were there to fire on us. But it was also clear that they didn't plan to fire on us just yet. I had never been this close to a tank before. As the crowd first surged backward when the tanks came, and then surged forward again as they grew used to their presence, my body was pressed directly up against this tank. I took some comfort in the fact that the guns of the tanks stuck way out behind me. When they started shelling, they wouldn't immediately hit me. I began scrutinizing the body of the tank, looking for a way to climb up and over it when they started shooting. We all stood there for about 15 or 20 minutes, wondering what to do. And then the old lady next to me did something astounding. Without a word to anyone, this tiny little lady grabbed a hold of the tank and hoisted herself up on top of it. She scrambled up the side of it and to the hatch on the top, and she began banging on the hatch. "Show yourself," she hollered. "I demand to speak with you." After a few moments, the hatch began to rotate, and then it was lifted up and back by a thin white arm. The head and shoulders of a very young, very frightened-looking boy popped out of the top of the tank. The old woman wasted no time. "Vor," she said, placing her thumb between her index and middle fingers and making a fist. This was a gesture I had seen many times in Russia and knew that it was what people did when they were calling out a thief. "You are a thief. Shame on you," she said. "This is a terrible shame upon you." The young soldier looked frightened, and he also looked embarrassed. Here he was, the captain of a deadly, powerful tank, and he still could not escape the wrath of his grandmother. In fact, he called her grandmother as he tried to respond to her. "Grandmother, grandmother," he said, "forgive me. I mean you no harm." This had no effect at all on the old lady. "This is a terrible shame upon you," she said again. "You are here to shoot us, to shoot me. You are going to fire on your own people. This is a terrible, terrible shame," she said. I could not stop thinking about this old lady, about the courage she had to come down here, about the obvious risk that she gave no thought to. "That's it," I thought. "If I ever make it out of here, if I ever get home, I am going to vote in every single election that ever happens. I will travel to other people's towns to vote in their elections." Maybe it is just choosing between the lesser of two terrible evils. Maybe it is just a symbolic gesture that has no real effect. I don't care. I will vote in every election for the rest of my life, and I will do it as a gift to you, this old lady who is clearly about to be shot by this embarrassed, irritated soldier. Because most certainly she was. These 24 tanks were here to put down this protest, just like they had in Hungary in 1956 and in Czechoslovakia in 1968. This was the Soviet Union. They didn't negotiate with protesters. And soon, this young man would grow tired of being humiliated and yelled at by this old lady in front of all these people. And he would climb out of his tank and stand on the top of it. And he would pull out his army-issued pistol and he would fire it in shame and terror directly into the people gathered at his feet. He would hit the old lady in the face or the chest, and we would catch her as she tumbled to the ground. The sound of the gunshot would cause the crowd to riot, I knew, and people would begin desperately trying to escape by throwing themselves into the dirty Moskva River that was right behind us, but it would be too late. I had to get out of here, and I had to get out of here now. I began looking around for a way to escape, before what was just about to happen happened. And as I looked around, I noticed something that was amazing. On every single one of the 24 tanks, people were doing exactly what this old lady had done. They were climbing up onto the tanks and they were talking to the soldiers that were inside the tanks. I saw a group of middle-aged housewives sitting around the opening of one tank, calmly and patiently talking to the soldier inside. I saw a businessman in a cheap brown suit, ridiculously still holding on to his briefcase, talking to one of the soldiers inside of another tank. All of these people were older or middle-aged. They were people who had lived their entire lives under the slow rot of communism, and they knew what it meant. They knew what it meant to go back to the way things were. They sat there, an older, wiser generation of Russians, trying to talk some sense into their offspring. They were engaged, quite literally, in the argument of their lives. After a few minutes of this, an older soldier, a couple of tanks to the left of me, came out of the hole of the tank and stood on the tank with his pistol. "Enough," he said. "That is enough. Get back. Get back." The people scrambled off of the tanks down back into the crowd, and we all held our breath as the 24 tanks flared to life. I pressed my body flat against the humming tank, waiting for the shelling to start, waiting for the verdict. And then slowly, the guns of the tanks, which were pointed at the crowd gathered there, began to turn. They turned away from the grandmothers and the uncles who were gathered there, and they pointed instead at the usurpers in the White House. An enormous cheer went up from the crowd, and I burst immediately into gasping sobs. Dmitry, who had been standing beside me the entire time, was ecstatic. He grabbed me in a hug and lifted me off my feet. Crying, he smiled at me. "Let us go get your ticket," he said. I made it to London on Tuesday and back to Florida in time to start my senior year of college 2 days later. My Russian professor gave me an A for the semester before it even started. I learned three things from my experience with the failed coup in Moscow. The first one I learned is that I have to vote. It's true, voting doesn't solve everybody's problems. Maybe your votes won't count. Maybe your votes will be lost or thrown in a ditch. Maybe the candidates that you have to vote for are all the same. In the Soviet Union, 99% of the citizens voted. They voted for Khrushchev and they voted for Brezhnev. They voted for Chernenko and Andropov and Gorbachev and Yeltsin and Putin. But voting isn't the only thing that you have to do in order to secure your rights and your freedom. It's a start, but it's not the finish. What you have to do, the people of Russia taught me on August 19th, 1991, is you have to be willing to risk yourself to preserve your freedoms. The coup in Russia by hardline communists took 3 days to fail. And looking back on it now, it seems inevitable. It seems like there was no way that the freedoms that these folks had won would ever be put back into a gray box and locked away. But it was because the people were willing to go out and put themselves in physical risk that they were able to do what they did. Without being willing to risk your own safety to secure your own freedom and others' freedom, voting can be just an empty shell. Your right to vote can always be taken away, as we've seen with gerrymandering and as we saw with the Supreme Court case that gutted the Voting Rights Act. Voting is just the start. In a country like Russia, it's not the end. The third thing I learned is that Russia was the place for me. I knew I had to go back, and 2 years later, I did. And that is when things really got interesting.
Robin Whetstone, quite an adventure.
Lot's Daughter Dreams of Her Mother by Opal Moore. In my dream of rose, each turn glitters. The road remembers your footsteps. Each night is crossroad, and I must choose a Babylon burning or be cursed or reason. Mother, this choosing is hard. These roads all slip away from me, smooth and white. In the moonlight, the dust shines. My feet are white with dust and light. What would you wish for me? Would you wish for me sodomy or safety? Which sacrifice? Mother, your body is road scratching back. Your memory intersects the spine where I stand with my white feet upon your heart. You are my road. You are my cross and crossing. You are my reaching back and my intention. You are my genius, my bedlam. You are my beginning. You are my death in full scribe. What if I came upon you in the road, sealed in the gray ash of your indecision, abandoned by angels, death caught in full scribe, like walking liberty, your torch is what you left behind. The crime of knowing your place, the place you knew, secret coupling, birthing blankets, a baby's sloppy open smile, first pains of blood, sex, betrayals, broken feathers, knowing what is human. You turn, look back, they say. They cannot say what you saw. I am your daughter. I lie down beside your husband. My flesh turns to water and salt in his dreams, he murmurs of angels. You and I are women, not angels, and practical in darkness. I throw up my hands, wait for the dark to open. In darkness, I kiss my phantomless face, taste your thirsty tears in my dream. Your shiny footprints shame me. So tell me, what a glimpse of future turn you back. I am your silence. You cross your road. Is this sleep? Mother, oh, mother, oh, mother, I am turning. My road is feathers.
I heard of J.J. Renaud through the National Storytelling Festival, but it turns out she lives near Athens.
I want to tell y'all a story about a bad little Cajun girl. One time down around Saint-Martin-Ville, there was a young woman. She was très jolie. She was very pretty. Now, she got to be of a marrying age, and all the people began to whisper behind her back because, you see, she didn't want to get married. And the people called her Marie Jolie. She didn't want to get married, no. She wanted to have adventures. She wanted to see the world. Now, her mama started getting worried about this thing. She didn't want that girl around her house the rest of her life. And after all, Marie Jolie was already 18 years old. She was an old maid. So she decided she was just going to have to choose a husband for that girl. She called her daughter to her side. She says, Marie Jolie, she says, since you won't pick a man, honey, I'm going to pick one for you. She says, I'm going to have a great big fat old dough. We're going to have a big old party, and we're going to invite every eligible man in the whole entire parish. I'm going to put this pumpkin up on that branch of that tree up there, out in the middle of the river. And whatever man can get that pumpkin, oh, Sherry, he's going to be your husband. Well, Marie Jolie said, oh, well, Mama, I guess that's as good a way as any of picking a man. And so they had the contest. And I mean, fellas came from all around to see that pumpkin and get that girl. Woo, because Marie Jolie was très jolie, if you know what I mean. Now, they all came, but among that crowd, there was one who really stood out. I mean, he was a tall, dark, handsome, good-looking devil, if ever there was one. And Marie Jolie kind of poked her mama in the ribs, and she said, "Woo, mama," she said, "I hope he gets the pumpkin." Well, they had the contest, and each man went up, and they all fell down. They couldn't get that pumpkin until it came time for that good-looking stranger. And, ooh, he whipped up that tree, got that pumpkin, and before she knew it, Marie Jolie was a married woman. Well, they started off down the road in his wagon. They're driving along, and things began to get a little bit strange, because every time she would look at her husband, she saw he was getting uglier and uglier and uglier. Well, they're driving along, and she's getting a little nervous about this. The road's getting darker and darker and darker, and they came around a bend, and all of a sudden a man stepped out, and he had a big, tall hat on, and his face was all in shadow, and he pointed a bony finger, and he said, "Give to me the horses which I lent you." And her husband said, "Chin, chin." He said, "Take your horses." And so the man unfastened the horses and led them away. And all of a sudden, Marie Jolie felt her husband's eyes upon her. She turned and he said, "Marie Jolie, get yourself down. Hitch yourself to the wagon and pull us home." Well, whew, she's pretty scared, you know. And so she got down and she hitched herself to the wagon. And she began to pull them all the way home. Well, at last, they got there. And she found herself face to face with her brand new mom-in-law. And her husband said, "Marie Jolie, stay here, see no one, go no place. My mama will take good care of you." And with that, whoo, he disappeared. And there was Marie Jolie with her new mama-in-law. And she said, "Please, tell to me, why is my husband so strange?" And the mama-in-law said, "Oh, Paul, Shari, oh, I hate to tell you this thing, but Shari, you have gone and made a terrible match." "What? What do you mean?" "Oh, Shari, I hate to tell you this thing, but Jean-Pierre, you have gone and married the devil." "What? The devil? You just trying to break up my marriage, old woman. You just jealous." "Oh, Shari, you don't believe me. Come with me and I'll show you." And she took Marie Jolie into the house and she opened up a secret door. And when Marie Jolie looked inside, she saw the devil's former wives all hanging from a hook. "Please, tell me, how can I escape from this place, please? I don't want to end up like them. Tell me how to go away, please, please." "Shari, this is what you must do. You must feed the rooster which wakes Monsieur Diable, the devil, 3 bags of corn instead of 1. The rooster will oversleep. And then, softly, softly, Shari, at dawn, creep out and fill your apron with 6 dirty eggs. They will protect you. But, Shari, be careful. Don't take the eggs that are clean. They're a bad luck." And so, Marie Jolie did as the mama-in-law told her to. She fed the rooster the corn. The rooster overslept. The next morning, Marie Jolie was creeping out. She filled her pockets full of those 6 dirty eggs, and she was just tiptoeing out of the gate when all of a sudden that rooster woke up and began to crow, "Cock-a-doodle-doo, cock-a-doodle-doo, Monsieur Diable, wake up, vite, vite, your wife is getting away." Well, Marie Jolie began to run as fast as she could run. I mean, she was burning rubber to get out of that place. Faster and faster and faster and faster, and she looked behind her, and she saw fire and smoke. Well, she knew who that was. And she took one of those eggs and she flung it over her shoulder and it landed with a huge boom. And there sprang up a fence as high and wide as the eye could see, made of wood. Well, her husband ran up to it and he screamed in anger. And he ran all the way back home to get his mighty golden axe that would cut through anything. Ran back and he cut through that wall. Once again, he was in hot pursuit of Marie Jolie. And she was running, running, running faster and faster and faster. Her heart was pumping. Her blood was like ice in her vein. She looked over her shoulder and she saw fire and smoke. She took another egg, whizzed it over her shoulder. Kaboom! Another wall as high and wide as the eye could see, this time made out of stone. The devil screeched in anger, took his golden axe, chopped it down again, and once again was running after her. She's running running, running, running as fast as she can go. Her heart is about to give out, and she looks over her shoulder, more fire and smoke, takes a third egg, throws it over her shoulder, kaboom! This time there was a fence made of iron as high and wide as the eye could see. The devil chops through it with his axe. She's running, running, running. She looks over her shoulder, and this time she sees the devil as he really is. He's dropped his disguise. She sees his forked tail waving about. She sees his cloven hooves raising puffs of dust. His horns are glinting in the sunlight. His eyes are burning yellow, and all over he's covered with red scales. He looks something like a boiled crawfish. Well, she was so scared. She was so frightened that she took those last three eggs and she threw them in the air as hard as she could go. But she wasn't looking what she was doing. And they fell down, boom, 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 right at her very own feet. And all of a sudden, there was a huge, mighty snake and river. It was the Mississippi. Well, she knew she couldn't swim that river. It was too wide. And here was her husband, the devil, coming up on her. And all of a sudden, she looked out right there in the middle, right there. There was an old grandmama cocodrilo, an alligator out there just floating in the water, soaking up some sun, you know. And she called out, "Grandmama, grandmama, save ma vie, grandmama. Save my life, aidez-moi, help me, grandmama." And the alligator swam up to the bank, and the alligator spoke. She said, "Oh, Marie Jolie, you are numb. How can I help you, Jean-Fille? Please, grandmama, help me get to the other side, please. I'm being chased. I'm being chased by the devil, and here he comes. Please, grandmama, help me. Vite, vite, climb on my back. I'll swim you to the other side." Well, Marie Jolie climbed on that alligator's back. Shoom, she's riding that alligator across that river. Alligator took her to the other side. Now here comes, oh, Monsieur Diable, the devil, and he's running up to the bank, and he begins to call out, "Grandmama, grandmama, aidez-moi, grandmama. Help me, grandmama, and I'll give you anything you want." Grandmama swimming. "Oh, it's you, Monsieur Diable. You are known. How can I help you? Vite, vite, take me to the other side. My wife is getting away." "Oh, mais oui, certainement. Climb on my back. Vite, vite, I'll take you to the other side." And so the devil climbed onto that cocodrilo's back, and she began to swim him across the river. But when she got to midstream, all of a sudden, Grandmama ducked under the water, and the current took the devil kicking and screaming downstream. He couldn't swim. There's not too much water where he's from. Well, some people say he landed down there around New Orleans, but that's another story. And as for Marie Jolie, well, she made it to the other side, and before she passed into the next life, well, she had many adventures and she saw many things. And after that time, the people called her Marie Esprit, Marie the Spirited One. And when the folks would say, "Marie, why is it that you never did get married again?" she'd just smile and say, "Well, you know, when you've been married to one devil, there's no need to go out looking for another one."
Sauvez ma vie, les flammes d'un feu.
pray for me, save my soul. I am condemned to the fires of hell.
Marie Joly by singer-songwriter and obviously storyteller J.J. Renaud.
The Heart of a Woman by Georgia Douglas Johnson. The heart of a woman goes forth with the dawn, as a lone bird, soft, swinging, so restless on. Afar over life's turlets and vales does it roam, in the wake of those echoes the heart calls home. The heart of a woman falls back with the night and enters some alien cage in its plight and tries to forget it has dreamed of the stars while it breaks, breaks on the sheltering bars.
That's our show. So this is David Oates saying goodbye and thanks for listening to Wordland. Wordland is a Monkey Sound production recorded in the studios of WUGA. If you have questions or comments, please call your radio station or send email to dvdoates@aol.com. That's dvdoates@aol.com. We'll be right back.